Toute ta faute. Peut-être de faux, peut-être de faux. Oh, oh.
Hello, welcome back to a new episode of With Open Mouths, the podcast. I'm your host, Carnita Lilla. Today, I'm excited to be joined by artist Jessica Karuhanga. Jessica's work spans lens-based technologies, sculpture, writing, drawing, and performance. I was lucky enough to visit her studio earlier this year in London, Ontario, and spend time seeing her beautiful work. Today, we talk about the central tenets of a practice. What does Black embodiment mean? How does sound intersect diasporic geographies? And what is the role of intergenerational knowledges? They wanted us in shade. They thought we would stay slaves. So thank you very much, Jessica. Thank you so much for talking with me today. And I would like to start by talking about your personal journey towards art as a practice. What kind of child were you?
I was a very introverted child and very imaginative child as well. I feel like my earliest memories were sort of playing with my siblings at my grandmother's house. She lived kind of more or less in the country, like a developing suburb, but her home was surrounded by woods and forests. I'd often like invent these sort of games or build forts or, you know, be running around from dawn till dusk, basically. And I also was an avid reader. I would read a lot of books. Just I could read a book a day and just fly through them. I spent a lot of time going to secondhand bookshops with my parents. And then in addition to that, I was an avid, I would draw a lot. So I had, whether it was like Kilroy notepads or sketchbooks, I just like couldn't stop or sit down. You know, my grandmother would put her Royal Daltons on the table. Those dolls they're endearing but kind of horrendous, but I would, you know, copy them sort of exactly. And as a kid, I taught myself perspective and all of those things. So the arts has always sort of been there. I did dance a bit as a child as well. So those were kind of my outlets, considering how timid I was. I didn't really speak a lot as a young kid. So in a way, those pathways were sort of my channel or voice or outlet.
Mm-hmm. Were you an only child?
I wasn't, but my siblings didn't. So my parents had me, and then my sister Angela came around when I was 5, and then Steph was born when I was 7. So that isn't a lot of time, but it also is significant when you're a young child, you know, and developmentally. So in a way, it kind of was an experience of only child, or just that kind of distance. Like, I feel like I took on, you know, being the firstborn child in an immigrant family, you're often, I take on these other leadership roles as the,
Yes.
And then in addition to that, like my dad is the patriarch of his family, an African family, and I'm his firstborn child. So there's these layers, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And kind of like seriousness.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. But that's interesting. So you felt as if you were born into this. You were like very much born into art. It was like just what you were doing, you know?
I can't remember a time where art wasn't a part of my life. And I was really, my family always really supported it. I remember my godparents getting me, I was really into at some point kind of animations, whether it was Don Bluth or Miyazaki, and they were like cells, so I could paint the cells and to make like animations. So my family was constantly, and family friends were constantly, you know, giving me support in that way. Mm-hmm. And
Yeah, that's amazing. So they were kind of feeding it.
They were really feeding it, yes.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I want to talk a bit about Black subjectivity and the way that your work explores like the collective concerns of Black subjectivity, such as like rage and grief, desire and longing, specifically within the context of Black embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think firstly, perhaps you could talk to us a bit about what Black embodiment is. And why it is such an evocative vehicle for you?
I think it's important for me because at some point, you know, growing up, I grew up in a post-industrial town in southwestern Ontario. I think to this day, you know, Black families maybe make up 1% of the population. It also has like one of the highest kind of air pollutant rates in North America, because a lot of our oil is produced there. So that geographic context was significant in terms of how also like alienated I felt growing up. So like representation really meant a lot to me as a young kid, whether it was like listening to like certain music on the radio station or watching like 106 in Park on BET. And different forms of like Black representation. Like I grew up listening to like disco records with my parents and like African music and like R&B. And I was really into neo soul as a young kid. I was way too young to understand the depth of the feelings of neo soul or like the blues, like the weight of it, the gravity, but still like I was like piercing through it. And in that desire for representation, I feel like at some point, I don't quite know when the switch happened. I also began to realize that like it almost wasn't enough, or there's a point where it's no longer sort of sufficient. So focusing on the embodiment, like a feeling, or felt like a more authentic way to connect with one another. And also because I think representation can be tricky, you know, I have a very specific, all of us have very specific lived experience or embodiments in terms of like class. You know, I grew up in a like multi-faith, multi-racial family. I myself am biracial. So I feel like all of those kind of layers come into play. So it just, I was never interested necessarily in being representation for anyone else. I just knew that there are points of contact where I could resonate with other folks, whether it be in terms of being Black and disabled or living for chronic illness, those types of kind of points of relation. So that's why that became almost a more authentic or meaningful way to kind of address those things. And then I didn't have to like limit myself or maybe pigeonhole myself, because I feel like sometimes you can do that, or you experiment with something and just, you know, there might be some like curators who want to collaborate with you that kind of like look through your work through a kind of reductive or diminutive lens, you know. I feel like it becomes more palatable that way. So that's why embodiment was really important to me.
I think that's really interesting, like how you kind of moved away from representation as kind of not speaking enough. You know, it wasn't enough to kind of get at the things that you were trying to engage with. I think that's really...
I also just got bored of representation. Like I have all my sketchbooks from when I'm busy on. I would draw my sisters, my like cousins, my parents, my grandparents. I would just draw everyone around me. And I feel like it almost felt too easy. Like I'm someone that I want to be sort of challenged. And I was like, what if I apply like literary or poetic devices that might be used in literature or prose, poetry, how can I apply those similar devices or strategies to like so-called visual art or musical strategies as well?
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah. I wonder if you could describe like one such work for us.
Okay, let me...
It's like all of your work.
Yeah. That's a good question. I guess... One artwork that's like pretty kind of abstract. That'd be interesting to talk about, because a friend of mine and colleague, Sohaila, curated an exhibition called Diasporic Bodies. I will check that to make sure that's correct. And she included the sculpture Through a Brass Channel. And I remember in class, a class I was teaching, this is in our department, a student bringing up that they really struggle with that work, that it's like kind of almost too esoteric. Mm-hmm. And that what they prefer was actually this more representational work that was a photograph, that was scans of, you know, some type of like traditional, like cultural cloth of cultural significance. And I thought that was interesting, because for me, I don't like when people just blithely insert things into a context or just use materials without like questioning even banal things like the supply chain of that like object. I'm always thinking about that, especially as a diasporic subject, when like so many resources and things are extracted from like my ancestral homeland. So, you know, with that piece, it's, you know, made up of masonry stones that the initial sculpture, it was a stone that I found outside of a, you know, an institutional building, and it just felt very like symbolic. And the brass bangle, the bangles are from trade shows that my dad used to sell jewelry at. That was probably one of his hustles or jobs when he came to Canada as a refugee. And then the just delicately kind of balancing the copper pipe on top, you know, that's used normally to kind of corral like water. And I thought there's a literal kind of function there, a utilitarian function, but also what does that mean kind of metaphorically when I think of like geographies and just kind of the transatlantic kind of between here and like the continent. So that's kind of what came up there. And I really try to teach that to students, because I feel like sometimes people that maybe don't have certain lived experiences just maybe teach kind of very like superficial ways of reading things, like just stick to, you know, the, what is the word I'm looking for? Like color theory, or just the like principles of art. And I feel like that's almost like not enough in this point in time in history, when everything is so political and charged and really feels quite catastrophic. So I feel like we have to kind of go deeper. I wasn't offended by this comment, but it was just interesting that students like, oh, I don't even get this piece. Like, I'm not even going to try. And that was actually, in fact, the very reason. It's almost like an insistence or wanting the audience or the visitor to like work. Like, I'm not here to make things easy for people, you know? I just don't think that's real.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested that you used the word corral water, mm-hmm. instead of like thinking of water as naturally flowing from right. a high place to a right. low place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinking about how you physically kind of change things, you mm-hmm. physically construct things, you know? Mm-hmm. I think, and I think that that is something that is very, like, it's, you know, embedded in your work, you know, that you shape, you know, you choose to shape things. I feel that like your current work that you're busy with and you have done for the past like 5 or 10 years has been a movement away from like the art object, mm-hmm. you know, and instead thinking about the resonances that it carries, but also the way the audience interacts with it. And yeah. as you showed, you know, it's very, you want people to work in order to get it, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of think of different ways of perceiving those masonry stones and the brass like pipes.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about how, like what your journey was like from like more traditional mediums to what we see today?
I really work learning in kind of traditional forms is very important, from, you know, analog photography to working with like plaster or welding or woodworking and things like that. And I still do those activities. Like I love carving wood. I don't know if those objects that I've carved, I mean, maybe that will be a thing one day, but I'm always kind of being active or making things. I feel like the journey away from that is an almost parallel journey to the representation question. I think there was a point when I was in art school where I was like, okay, I want to learn a certain skill set, and then I can sort of break these rules or question these sort of parameters. And I became very interested in, you know, postmodern, like dance artists, like whether it's like Trisha Brown or, oh my God, why am I blanking on so many names? Yvonne Rainer, Anna Halperin. Also looking at interesting sound artists where they're kind of breaking down kind of sound in these sort of abstract ways. I became interested in, people like Alan Kapow talking about the sort of everyday things that kind of felt derivative or an extension of like some of these kind of dadaist notions. And I thought about that. I'm like, okay, my precedents might be different, but like, how can I like think about that more like deeply? Like what does pedestrian movements mean to me as a, you know, first gen diaspora person? So that was kind of the kind of stigma that went on. Like, I just remember something clicking in me when I realized that anything could be material. So, when we think of material, we think of, I don't know, like plaster, metal, like we think about almost the elements. And I wanted to kind of depart from that. So that it was, yeah, it was just this, a switch happening in school when I realized quite literally anything is material. And that was part of me starting to understand research differently as like practice, you know?
So was there like specific, were there specific artists that you were drawn to? You know, because I've like noticed that you speak about certain people almost as kind of people who kind of have a like similar life experience or similar, you know, something.
David Hammons was a huge, huge artist for me. Probably one of my favorite artists. The way that he works with kind of not just symbolism, but the materials he uses almost are, I don't know how to call it anything, but almost like reliquaries. Like they're charged objects he uses. You know, when I think of the piggy bank piece with the cowrie shells, or the towering basketball nets, or the piece Night Train that with the ash bolt at the bottom, which is one of my favorite sculptures of his. So he's, yeah, probably one of my top favorite artists. Also, in terms of performance, I really loved, you know, Joan Jonas or Bruce Nauman's work, like a lot of those 1960s kind of performance artists, or with the experiments they're doing at that time. And then in terms of like more recent contemporary performance, I really love Okwi Okwuegbesili's work. Her piece Bronx Gothic is like a gorgeous autobiographical piece, and I got to see her perform another work, and it was incredible. So I don't know, there's certain works you see that affect you a particular way, where it almost feels, it really feels like an experience. It feels live, you know, even if you're looking at a still work. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that have kind of transformed me or altered me or make me want to continue this kind of pursuit of a certain kind of practice.
And poetry and music, other kinds of affective.
In terms of like music, oh my gosh, there's so many things, you know. I think of like I really like anything like the Erykah Badu. Oh my God, why am I blanking on the music? There's so many of them. In terms of poetry, you know, Amiri Baraka, Okot, Bitek, also Yusuf Komenyaka, Fred Moten, and also like Norbeze Philip. There are so many. The more that it's about kind of breaking things down and getting at the kind of the rhizome of something, the more that it really tends to move me.
Mm-hmm. And it feels, I mean, it sounds like it's a patchwork of all those things kind of happening simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Jessica, what role do you think like art school played? You know, did it like facilitate this, or did it kind of sharpen what to not be and what you didn't want to be?
Well, for me, art school was challenging. I definitely had professors that became mentors that, you know, really believed in me, but I also had a lot of folks that were inadequate or didn't understand that I would have different precedents, right? You know, I definitely had people that were like, I don't understand why you're doing this African art thing. Like, you know, it like just quite frankly, like problematic and racist. So for me, what I, from very early on, I remember thinking that the institution is a frame that you can kind of bend. So, you know, if I was given an assignment with parameters that felt extremely limiting or like patronizing, I would find a way to talk about what it is I wanted to talk about within those kind of parameters. Like I would, you know, even if it was super limiting, like you're like only allowed to use these colors and it has to be like a representational whatever, like I was beyond that. And it's tough because you understand now, beyond the other side, I understand that you're trying to fit a certain like curriculum and you're trying to make sure that everyone has a fair experience, but it doesn't always work for everyone, you know? Mm-hmm. I think it took me a while to realize that I could be an artist, even though I always, in fact, was. It was like the identification thing that I struggled with for a while. At the same time, although it was a kind of like tenuous or kind of complicated fit, I still can see like the gifts it gave me. So even if I had, even where there was resistance, like I still needed that to be able to produce certain types of work, you know, to have a space that wasn't the most accommodating or felt like antithetical or hostile to like my like thriving, you know? It seems like some things have changed. Like sometimes I see younger people thriving, that really excites me. Like I don't feel envious or jealous, or you know how some people let that feel bitter towards younger. I don't feel that at all. You know, if anything, that's how you want things to happen. You want it to just be better.
Yeah.
For whoever comes after you, you know? So if anything, it was kind of like a thwart. It was like a challenging, it was a thing that was that I was pushing up against. And then when I finally was out of art school, there were another set of challenges, like just trying to survive in the world in a recession. But then like I feel like I started to make my most real work like outside of like those parameters. So
And you spoke about being on the other side, mm-hmm. and you actually teach in that. What is that experience like? Just actually getting to choose what to, you know, teach students, getting to kind of, yeah, just, you know, like having things like completely flipped.
I think it's great because I feel like, you know, I come from a family of teachers, which really does shape how I observe and look at things. I remember my dad taking me to take your kid to work day. And I remember hearing some teachers talk, you know, complain or talk disparagingly about so-called problematic students. And at a young age, I remember thinking, well, they just have different needs or learning styles. Like, I didn't have the language to talk about disability or to talk about, you know, whatever it might be. But I remember always thinking, like, if I ever have something, a role like this, I'm going to do things differently. And I think the key thing is that, like, I mean, of course, my feelings still get hurt if, like, I don't fuse right with the students. Like, it's hard not, I don't personalize it, but it's hard. It still affects you. But what helps me is that to always remember that, you know, teaching is like a role or occupation, so to have boundaries around that. And then in terms of like mentorship, that like mentees choose mentors, you know, because otherwise it feels like a predatory or like you're trying to live vicariously through a kind of younger person. It feels like maybe more harmful than it is positive. Mm-hmm. So like I've always struggled with people. I'm also an Aries, but I always struggled with people that would be like kind of patronizing or take on this like I know and you like it, that it wasn't exchange. And I was like, well, you have so many blind spots and you're dismissing these things that are my precedents, that are my material. Like, I can't trust that, you know? And, you know, luckily I have a mother who can be very obstinate. And then, you know, I have a father who, you know, the very channel through which he arrived in Canada was through his like kind of political like defiance to like a dictatorship, you know, there's no way when I come from such like these backgrounds that I was gonna like take anyone trying to enforce upon me one kind of monolith. So ironically, like, or not ironically, truly, it's like a geographic political kind of route that informs how I approach like teaching. And then in terms of the material, you know, it changes every year. So I still have to go through all the different mediums, but like, I'll try and ask my students in the first class, you know, what their special interests are. Maybe it's cultural stuff that matters from that point. Maybe it's not. And then I try to like cater the material that way. So, you know, I remember having a student who wanted to do a project about women in sports, and she's like, you're not allowed to do that. And there's no precedent for that, which is, you know, not true. So I just, you know, I don't think it's my job to give them kind of permission. Like, I don't want them to look to gatekeepers, like to get in that mindset. But if they need me to be a kind of representation to almost like guide or like just like be affirming, that's what I feel like my role can be, is to be affirming.
Yes, and I think that is so, it's so desperately needed in like the art school environment, because it is like entirely traditionally it's a gatekeepery kind of place. You know, it's about who makes it through and this impossible standard of what an artist is, you know, which shouldn't be, shouldn't be at all.
And also art school should be about fun. I feel like you shouldn't be trying to make masterpieces when you're like, you should always be doing your best and like, and be great. But like, I feel like that like paradigm of the masterpiece of the great artist is a very like dangerous kind of narcissistic pathway. Yeah.
And I but feel also like a very male Eurocentric kind of, you know,
because the best art comes from, to me, and the longest lasting stuff is most, it comes from risk. It comes from the unknowable. It comes from like kind of not really knowing what you're doing. When you're forming, when you're shaping, you know, like, yeah. So that's how I feel about that. And I try to like knock that out. I'm like, you think you know who you are, but like, you should just be trying to like undo all of that. And I feel like some of them have a bit of a, not a crisis. It feels like a crisis to them, but it's not really, you know.
Well, I think, I mean, just talking about teaching, and you know, it's actually, it kind of makes you quite vulnerable. You know, you kind of have to think about your own processes and your own shortcomings. And I think, and just like yourself as a human being standing and being, you know, like honest and open to people. And I think like a lot of your work has to do with like your own like positionality and your own body and your vulnerability. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I just think it's important to be kind of honest in that way. Like, I think with the like shortcomings, this, that, and the other, like, you're saying, I was thinking of something. Because I am like, I do have these like flaws or shortcomings, like in terms of the teaching context, invariably you're going to be activated sometimes or triggered or whatever it might be, and vice versa, right? Like a lot of people I teach have never experienced like a Black woman who becomes like feminized or maybe like hypermasculine, like depending on the context. They've never experienced someone like me in an authoritative position. So I'm constantly being like, while there are students that see themselves in me and like that resonance, I'm also experience a lot of like kind of resistance or hostility, like almost undermining me, going over me. And that piece is challenging. And then in terms of the art, I think like I'm also really interested in film and other things. And I've always wanted to, before I started bringing other people into my work, it felt important to start with myself in an almost like ethical way, so I could really understand what the relationship of even something like, in terms of documenting performance work, what the relationship historically of the camera to like Black subjects or African subjects or colonized subjects is, you know? And so it helped for me to be like responsible in bringing other people into my work as like subject matter or material, or like becoming kind of objects in a way that I start myself before I could even to put myself in that position of vulnerability before I could even ask anyone to collaborate in that way. So that's really where it started. And I think there's a huge misunderstanding. I remember in art school having like a instructor sort of say, you know, oh, I hate kind of performance. It's like so kind of narcissistic. And I remember thinking like, I might have even said this as a young person, like, well, you could argue that about almost any art practice. Like depending, I think it comes down to like, you know, who the kind of conduit or artist is or what their intentions are. But in terms of like being kind of having self-importance or whatever. But I feel like for the performance that I'm interested in isn't actually about, there's no theatrics. It's not about performing a thing. It's about enactments, right? And there may or may not be like witnesses to that. That's more how I like to frame it. So yeah, it was very important for me to kind of start with that. And also maybe just think about things that I wasn't seeing, or just like what how I'm living, like what are the immediate things kind of around me that are affecting me in my day-to-day life. And I just kind of, I was like, all, I kind of deferred worrying about whether it'd be effective or whether it would resonate with people or if people could see themselves in the work. I kind of was, I wasn't too concerned with that in the making of it. I just needed to get this kind of thing out. And I also thought it might be like therapeutic or kind of healing. I just feel like it felt important to do because there's something that I saw missing or I just wasn't seeing out in the world.
Yeah. I wonder if your background and experience in performance relates somehow to how you view audiences who see your other art. As like collaborative viewers. Could you speak to that? Because it's very powerful.
Thank you. Well, for me, I feel as though art is always an experience and kind of quite physiologically or cognitively or whatever, like there are processes that are going on, you know. And I feel, you know, certain like abstraction, forms of abstraction really moved me in that way. You know, there might've been like free jazz music that moved me a particular way. And so those were really things that were informing or influencing how I think about work. And then also actually in terms of like choosing materials, I'd say a lot of like kind of hip hop. I mean, everything, every kind of music now seems to be used different forms of sampling, whether or not it's classifiably hip hop. But I was also thinking about that kind of metaphorically, like, oh, I could pull from these kind of threads and what happens almost like cooking, like what happens when I mix these kind of things together. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the audience, so whether I'm making a sound piece or whatever the materials are, even if it's many separate artworks that are together and become a have a conversation, become a new kind of symbiosis forms, I'm always trying to almost like anticipate patterns of human behavior. So like, you know, you have the so-called white cube, or maybe it's like offshoots of that. And so I like to spend time in the place where I'm going to perform or I'm going to install the work and kind of plan or map things out. Cause I'm thinking, okay, people are going to navigate or go through space this way. They'll probably go here. Some will go this way. Like what are different sight lines or points of entry that can kind of happen. And I try to make, innumerable kind of events or points of activation. So I'm always sort of thinking about that, whether it's having two disparate sound pieces in opposite corners and what happens when those sound waves like meet and merge, and what if someone incidentally happens to be at that point of contact, you know? And I like to make it, to complicate things, I like to direct the gaze or direct the movement, but also not have control over it. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually trying to control the audience at all. I'm just, for me, it comes from a place of wanting to be like generous or give like an offering, like, kind of like, you know, an olive branch, or like, here I'm, what you do with that is like kind of no longer my like business, you know? Because I feel like it's a bit dangerous to be a bit too, if you're too precious or sentimental about the objects you make, where you're like, it's mine, it belongs, and this is the only way to like read it. When you're too didactic, like didactics, I think, are meant to be, I don't mean quite literally the didactics on the wall, although those can also be an interesting function. But mm-hmm. I mean, when the artwork is stuff, when it's almost too, like if I can like look, experience artwork and read, and it's a one liner and I can move on, mm-hmm. like I'm not interested in that. So it's like, I'm okay with those confusing moments. Like when that student was like, I don't get this piece, you know, yeah. I can accept that, you know? And I also can accept that not everything I make is for everyone, you know?
But then I think also there's kind of like very careful balance between giving people what they want and expect and making them work for it in different ways. Mm-hmm. Like whether it's physically kind of navigating through spaces or whether it's emotionally. Mm-hmm. I think like all of those things are kind of, it like gives like the texture, like texture to your own. But I really loved like what you said about your work being an offering, mm-hmm. you know? And I'm just thinking of how your work has a very rich sense of your own African heritage. You know, could you talk a bit about how your personal geographies shape your artistic practice?
I think like growing up, it was very important to me to know where I'm from. And it's interesting, these like parallels that happen. So when I think about like, my mom, like her family is from an area in Essex that's a very kind of industrial seaport area. So it's interesting that like as a young child, she immigrated to Canada and then met my dad, and then they ended up in Sarnia. So I just think that's an interesting parallel. And then with my dad, you know, he grew up in kind of rural, like Western Uganda, and like that kind of life in the village. And I feel like my parents are always like really making sure that I knew where I was from. So our home, you know, we have the batiks and the masks and the drums and and sculptures and all those things all over our house. My dad would read us poetry and Mwen Kole, which is our like a native tongue, our tribe's language. Mm-hmm. And so I was always kind of connected to that way. And then also, like, you know, my family would bring me give us storybooks and stuff, and other kind of African like culture. So I grew up having like storybooks that were written in Swahili and like other things as well. So I grew up having and storybooks about indigenous families to Canada. So I grew up having a thing that was very much materials or like things to kind of foster me as a kid that were very much pointed towards my diasporic experience in the context of like Turtle Island, you know, which I'm super grateful for. And I think it's, again, because I grew up come from family teachers, and whether it was overt or explicitly about like how the education system wasn't necessarily teaching that history. Like I grew up, we weren't doing land acknowledgements. So it was a very, like it almost like the talk of colonization was very much relegated to the past. Like it was a past tense thing. You know, this kind of the birth of neoliberal kind of frameworks of whatnot in the 90s, you know, like Gap ads, like that type of representation, like they were like, okay, well, there was this additional education that happens in this space. And so, you know, I didn't go back to Uganda. The first time I ever went to Uganda, I was 30. It was 7 years ago. And wow. And it's because I grew up in a working class family. Also, my dad wasn't safe for him to go back until the early 90s. I think it was like 91 or that he went back for the first time. And so growing up, I have, you know, these vivid memories of back then you would, before WhatsApp and everything, you would, you know, be calling on the phone and there'd be like a slight delay. And it was such a like confusing, like, you know, and I remember talking to my grandfather and my dad would be kind of translating, but like, and then I remember when he went back the first time, he brought back like these bracelets my cousins made for us. And I don't know, like growing up, I just had this excitement and I was so, and also people, I grew up where kids thought Africa was like a country, you know? And so I became obsessed with geography actually as a kid, and memorizing or knowing maps from all over the world. So I, in my head, I was like, if I ever meet someone, whether they're from Afghanistan or Mexico or whatever, I'd have a sense of like what they mean when they discuss place. Like it became very important for me. I was like, it sucks to feel alienated this way. I'm like, I will never make anyone else feel that way. So I feel like my interest in place came out of that, like longing or desire, or like a necessitated kind of thing, you know, and also just like tragic, horrific circumstances that made it so like I exist at a certain point in time here and not like there, and imagining what, you know, in another dimension, like what that might look like. So that those things are very important to my art practice. Also arts, I think all over Africa, like arts and life, they're not really separate the way they are in other, like in a more Western context, like they've never been separate. So yeah, it's like my family is always dancing when we get together, and like even going to church is like way more lively and fun than like the Catholic Italian somber upbringing that I church that I have to go to. So for me, that became a really kind of important outlet, and I think that's why I was so drawn probably to you know, like hip hop or kind of blues or neo soul, these other kind of diasporic like musical movements, because they're ultimately about kind of hybrid. There's a hybridity that's happening in some of those artists, right? In terms of where they're like pulling from, and so that became almost like a metaphor for me to like help me understand, like almost like, okay, like through sound you can do collage. I how do I apply assemblage or collage or like sampling to other like forms of practice?
Like something that you mentioned that stuck with me was like a telephone call that you have with like your grandfather in the 90s, and what that captures, but also what it kind of starts to create in your mind. You know, it gives you the sense of time and distance that we kind of lack now. So, you know, and it's also like you get like access to a whole other world, because there's like background sounds, there's chickens or whatever that would be, you know, all of those kinds of things. So, like, I'm really interested, you know, thinking about Catherine McKittrick's idea of hearing geographies differently, that she writes about in Demonic Grounds. And she suggests that space and place are always connected to audible demands. And she asks us not to think about the where of politics, but also how the production of space is not a silent process. And I think it's like when you were speaking about that, I thought like, that is it. That is exactly it. You know, like sound is, and I think especially in, well, not particularly, but especially in Africa, sound bleeds. You know,
It
there is,
bleeds.
it bleeds. There's no such thing as like a quiet space. Like a quiet space is a dead space.
No, it's true. No, it really is about that. Like there was something I was thinking that was coming to me. I'm gonna try to get it back, but no, sound really does travel. It resonates. It just reverberates, and it depends on like maybe what point or place. With the phone thing, my dad was sharing a memory with me like last summer about with his older sister, who my sister's named after. And she worked at her job was you know, when you move the telephone things, like she
I
would,
know.
yeah.
Yes.
And so he has this memory where he would like when he was after school, he'd go stop by her work, and she would walk him home with her. But he would sit on her lap, and he was like, she would let me like pull the things out. And that was like this beautiful memory he had of like being like, wow, I'm connecting with this like world out there, you know, like growing up in like the village. And so and then yeah, I think about sound a lot, like in terms of like forms of like communication, like just like we have there's a traditional form of poetry in Uganda called I'm gonna butcher the pronunciation, this I can share the spelling with you. Bivuku, and it's like a call and response type of poetry, and it's a form of like storytelling. And that like my dad would teach us like kind of growing up. It was like really cute. He's like, okay, now you say this part. And I just think about like, oh, now we share these things almost like they've become kind of art forms. But there was a point where like this is also a form of like communication and kind of like coded kind of ways, or certain like you know, drum rhythms as well, another musical thing. And I think that's almost like a thing that feels like native to like all over the like world, like different kind of drum resonances. So yeah, I think about that a lot. I think about the ways that certain, for me, smell and sound are the two things that activate memories, like in a very, in the most like haptic, intense kind of like way that can like translate, transmute, transplant me to another like time and space. It's really, it really comes down to that like sense, you know. And it does take you to like not just this particular like place, but like also time sometimes as well.
I like when I listened to your piece, All of Me, I got that sense, like you managed to capture that. Could you talk a bit about how All of Me, the sound piece, is very much about hidden histories, even though, you know, and that it disrupts like traditional understandings of geography.
Yeah, I with that piece, I started out thinking about, you know, in moments of kind of crises, we might kind of romanticize the past or become nostalgic, or we long for this kind of future, like, and this is what how things will be. And so I wanted to ask, like, friends of mine, like people that, like family and family friends, people in community that I respected, kind of about memory or those types of things. And so a lot of these were recorded over the phone, so there's a bit of a glitch or a, like, the sound quality is very intentional. And then I just spent months like listening to every person's tapes and then thinking about what sounds made sense in response to that. And I worked very intuitively. Like it started off one way and then it changed to another. So some of it is very like kind of dreamy type music, like where you feel like you're almost floating in space. Some of it's like trap music. Some of it, there's some like banjo with like a very twangy, like you can almost picture like you're sitting on a porch and there's like dust like blowing past, and I like that, like everyone will imagine a different space when they're hearing these voices. It's almost like you're listening to an auntie or a cousin or your sibling or you know, tell this story. And I also like that they don't necessarily, because I'm pulling from different musical styles that you maybe associate with different points of time in history. Like if you hear a certain like drum beat or drum kit, there's certain drum kits you'll associate with, like the 80s like pop music, like New Jack Swing, or there's like certain sounds certain brass instruments or horns you'll associate with like the early 90s and X point, you know. So I wanted to kind of play off that a little bit, you know, be a little bit experimental that way, so that people start to build these kind of and bridge these connections. And I don't know, I think music can be very active in particular ways. Like I'm not a sound engineer. I haven't studied. I know there's certain like pitches or like things that can actually have like kind of healing properties, or they might affect you and like or trigger or activate certain things. I don't know. I wasn't thinking about that necessarily with this work, but people usually go to it. I think they're going to a sound piece. Hey, I'm going to just listen to a few minutes and then go. But usually people stay and listen to the whole piece, which is almost about 30 minutes long. Like most people. So when I saw that, it became clear to me that it was important to have like a bench or a booth or somewhere people can like sit and lean and spend time with the piece. And then the last installation, we used wireless headphones. So if some people wanted to walk around with them, they could as well. It's definitely it's definitely one of the more meaningful pieces that I've made. Like, and inviting other people into the work is really important for me as well.
I mean, I think what makes it really effective is that people are so honest, and I think that's why people want to, you know, they want to listen, because it feels like they're speaking to somebody who's very dear to them, you know, so I think that's beautiful. And I think it works very well.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Jessica, it's been fantastic speaking to you. I'm so glad that we could go a bit deeper into your work. I think that's what it needs. It needs people to talk about and to write about and to think about and to feel.
Yeah,
you know, it's not something that you just look at. Absolutely not.
Yeah. I appreciate that so much.
So thank you very much. Thank you for joining me.
I'll talk to you soon. Okay.
Thank you too. Okay. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to With Open Mouths. Special thanks to Jessica Karuhanga for speaking with us today. I'm your host, Connie Talela. This podcast is produced by Danuta Seerhaus and Agnes Etherington Art Center in partnership with Queen's University's campus radio station, CFRC 101.9 FM. Episodes are edited and mixed by Chancellor Maracle. The music is composed by Jamil 3DN and produced by Elroy EC3 Cox III. Episodes of With Open Mouths are released monthly, and you can find them on Digital Agnes, CFRC's website, and on your favorite podcasting platform. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a review and subscribe now so that you don't miss a single episode. We'll see you next time. This is what they envy, and the culture that's within me. Know your word, sister, protect the soul.